cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
So another U.S. data drop, you know it well. PPI rising in February by the most in 6 months, driven by higher fuel and food costs. And that kind of added to evidence, Tim, that inflation, it remains a bit elevated.
Okay, we got some separate data, too, that showed retail sales rose last month by less than forecast after a steep drop to the start of the year. That underscores concerns about the durability of consumer spending. Meanwhile, applications for jobless benefits decreased to a three-week low. When we look at all the data we got today, I think this was the most consequential day of the week.
Let's see what Mike McKee has to say about it. He's Bloomberg News International Economics and Policy Correspondent, joining us right here in studio. Was this the biggest day?
That's a good question.
We did have CPI earlier this week, but...
Well, it's interesting the contrast between PPI and CPI, and they don't relate directly to each other. They each have more of an input into PCE than the Fed's favorite indicator than each other for the most part. And anything that comes up in PPI at the raw goods level will take a while to get into CPI. But CPI food was flat, no increase at all in PPI. Food went up. The numbers were not good, as you mentioned. A 6/10 rise in the headline PPI, largely energy, but it was double what we saw last month and double expectations. I tend to look at the Supercore PPI, which you take out food, energy, and what they call trade services, which is basically for retailers and wholesalers what their margins are. It can be a way of looking at company margins and how they're doing.
Right.
And that went up 4/10 after a 6/10 gain in January. So we are seeing some return of inflation pressures down below. Now, this is 1 month. Torture any Fed official, they'll say it's only just 1 month. But it is something that has to be on their radar screen now as they get ready to come up with a new set of economic projections and dot plot.
All right. So let's bring in also Daniel Hornung. He's deputy director of the National Economic Council. He's there on the lawn of the White House. Daniel, great to have you here with Mike and Tim and myself. On inflation, is the White House confident that the Fed will ultimately get to that 2% mark? Or is there any kind of internal conversations that maybe 2% isn't the right mark here, that there are macro issues going on that maybe is going to keep inflation higher post-pandemic, 4 years out? But nonetheless, many have said things have changed here in our economy.
Well, it's good to be with you. You know, I won't comment on monetary policy and the Federal Reserve. You know, I think what I can say, if you take a step back, you know, our progress on inflation does continue down from, you know, a peak of 9% to the 3% range. Always, I think we've expected some seasonality in January and February. We didn't expect the progress to continue on a straight line. But I think if you look at what we have from CPI and PPI and now looking ahead to core PCE for the month of February, expect, you know, some continued progress there on that core annual inflation number. And, you know, from the president's perspective, I think, as you saw in the State of the Union, a continued focus on his part of continuing to really make clear to the American people that he has a series of plans that would lower costs for American consumers, and really drawing a contrast with the Republicans in Congress, who have not taken up his plans and in some cases have focused more on other issues like tax cuts for large corporations and the wealthy.
Well, those are long-term plans. They will take years to have really an effect on prices. Does the president have anything, or is there anything that the National Economic Council is suggesting that would help the Fed in its goal and bring down inflation in the short run? Because obviously you have a kind of November 5th deadline for convincing Americans that things are better.
Well, it's also on that front to look at the progress that has been made, really the significant progress in resolving disruptions in supply chains and getting Americans back into the labor force. Really, I think, a result in part of some of the president's policies to drive a strong recovery. That has contributed significantly to bringing inflation down while keeping a strong job market. In addition to the proposals that I talked about a moment ago to do things like lower the cost of housing and lower healthcare costs, the president is also focused on using the administrative tools he has to do things like taking on junk fees, where we're seeing hidden fees that make it more difficult for consumers to understand the true cost that they're being charged. So you'll see the president focus on those kinds of administrative actions as well.
Can you talk a little bit about the conversations happening within the White House, within your circle, about communicating what you all see as achievements when it comes to the strong economy that by many measures people would consider a strong economy? Because it doesn't necessarily seem like it's totally resonating with voters poll after poll.
Well, I think there are two important things I'd say. The first is really making clear that in part because of the president's policies, we've had one of the strongest recoveries in the world, strongest recoveries on record. And what that has meant is even after accounting for inflation, wages are higher than they were before the pandemic. Wealth is higher than it was before the pandemic, but also being very clear that the president understands there's more work to do to lower costs for families, and that he has a very concrete set of plans that would do that, again, really different from Republicans in Congress who focused, instead of on lowering costs for the middle class, on cutting taxes for large corporations and the wealthy.
You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, Daniel, is some of the macro issues. And I understand, you know, the White House staying away from specifically what the Fed is doing and Fed policy. But having said that, you guys watch, obviously, the cost pressures on Americans here. I think about something like macro factors like tech isolationism, protectionism. President Biden, of course, just coming, you know, out, was it this morning or in the last 24 hours, about U.S. Steel retaining American ownership. And I do wonder about, are there substantial macro factors out there that you guys are having internal discussions out that maybe need us to maybe rethink about some of the cost pressures that might remain on Americans longer term?
Look, I think from the president's perspective, we need to be sure that our economic strategy is durable, is resilient, and is leading to the kind of long-term growth that can be broadly shared. We think it's very important that we have a strong international partnerships and an open economy. At the same time, we need to make sure that American workers are feeling the benefits of our economic policy, that the middle class is feeling the benefits of our economic policy. That includes things like investing in a strong manufacturing base here in the United States. And it also includes things like making sure that our tax code is fair so that middle class Americans, in some instances, aren't paying higher tax rates than billionaires. So you'll see a continued focus from us on those range of issues.
Well, speaking of manufacturing, why is the president opposed to Nippon Steel buying into a U.S. steel company? They're an ally. The plants would remain here. So what's the problem?
Well, the president this morning in his statement said that he's of the belief that a U.S.-operated and U.S.-owned steel sector is vital to the national security interests, economic interests, and supply chain interests of our country. There's a process from here, but I won't get ahead of that process. I'll just stay with what the president said this morning.
But in terms of just the pushback, you know, about pushback on China, you know, will there be some adjustments to the Trump, let's talk about Section 301 tariffs on China, to align with the president's priorities? And more broadly, how are you thinking about the intersection of China policy and the president's domestic economic agenda?
Well, look, there's an ongoing review of the Section 301 tariffs. I'd say more broadly, with respect to our economic relations with China, I think that the president has been clear that we should build a strong competition with China, ensure that we're promoting U.S. interests, But also where we can work with the Chinese on mutually beneficial and mutually agreeable issues that allow us to create a strong economy here in the United States.
Well, the administration has been considering additional tariffs on China and perhaps in some other countries in the region as transfers become a big issue. Is that something you would do before the election?
Again, we have an ongoing review of the tariffs that I won't get ahead of, and merely say, I think from the president's perspective, we need to ensure that our trade policy, like the rest of our economic strategy, is really focused on boosting living standards, boosting wages, and boosting economic well-being for the middle class in this country.
Well, so appreciate your time. Daniel Hornig, thank you so much. Deputy Director of the National Economic Council there on the lawn of the White House, talking about, obviously, the inflation prints today and yesterday, and also more broadly about administration policy. And, of course, our thanks to Bloomberg News International Economics and Policy Correspondent Michael McKee. Mike, thanks so much.
Well, of course, also on the agenda down in Washington is the future of TikTok. And it's up in the air right now because one day after the U.S. House of Representatives voted to ban it in the U.S., it could get sold to new ownership to alleviate what U.S. lawmakers say are national security concerns. Meantime, enter former U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, because he's got an idea when it comes to new owners of the wildly popular social media app. Check out what he said earlier on CNBC.
I think the legislation should pass, and I think it should be sold. I understand the technology. It's a great business, and I'm going to put together a group to buy TikTok.
You're trying to buy TikTok?
I am, because this should be owned by U.S. businesses. There's no way that the Chinese would ever let a U.S. company own something like this in China.
That's former U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin earlier on CNBC. With more on TikTok, with us from our L.A. Bureau, Bloomberg News technology reporter Alex Barranca. Alex, good to have you with us this afternoon. So what do we need to understand here about how likely it is or how realistic it is that a group of U.S. investors, along with former Treasury Secretary, could actually buy an independent TikTok?
Well, there are a few hurdles to clear before that's even an option. This bill still has to pass through the Senate, which we've written could be a tougher battle than we saw in the House. But let's assume that if happens, let's assume that this bill does pass and the company has 165 days to either sell, divest from ByteDance or be banned in the U.S. For a group like Steve Mnuchin to actually acquire this company, there are a few options. They could acquire it outright. Bloomberg Intelligence analysts valued it at $35 to $40 billion for just the U.S. business. So they would need a pretty significant check size. When we've seen deals like this in the past, I think Twitter might be a decent example if they want to keep this company private. About a third of that is debt, two-thirds of that is equity. So that's a lot of dollars there. If that group comes together, whether it's Mnuchin or other buyers, it would also need the review of the president. The way that this bill is written right now, the president would have to sign off on any kind of agreement, and we'd have to kind of clear the fight that might come out of China. The Chinese Foreign Ministry has said in the past that they would block any kind of sale. So a lot of ifs there, but it does seem like Steve Mnuchin is a person who might know how this goes down. You'll recall, as the Treasury Secretary under Trump, he oversaw CFIUS. That is the kind of intergovernmental agency that reviews deals and was very involved in the prior dust-up with TikTok when Trump tried to ban it in 2020. So the man surely knows the asset, as well as a lot of people out there in the industry might look at this as an amazing asset. But as I said, there are a lot of ifs until we get to that point.
Well, what do you make of the former U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin coming in here? I mean, he's obviously someone who knows how government plumbing works, specifically when you're talking about, as you said, foreign deals here. So I don't know, what are you hearing about kind of he specifically coming in potentially with a group here to make a deal?
He certainly knew how to operate under the government in the Trump organization. And because he knows kind of the players that would be involved in CFIUS, not only the Treasury, but folks from the DOJ branch and other intergovernmental agencies, he might know what it means to actually clear some of those national security concerns, which certainly have existed before now, as this review in the government of TikTok has been an ongoing process. He also is very involved in the banking industry. He certainly knows financial financiers and might be able to kind of swing the tides to his end. I'm hearing some comparisons to someone like Elon Musk. What Mnuchin doesn't have that Musk did have is a war chest of his own. What Mnuchin might have is contacts elsewhere. I know he has a lot of ties to places like Saudi Arabia.
Alex, how much would this cost, do you think?
So Bloomberg intelligence analysts are valuing the U.S. business at $35 to $40 billion. If you slap a deal premium on that, we could see something that's higher. So not insignificant when it comes to just TikTok's U.S. business.
That's real money, Carol.
It is real money. 10 seconds, Alex. Oracle, 4 years ago under Trump, they were considered as somebody who could get involved with TikTok. Is that likely to come back very quickly?
They have more debt than they did back then. Currently, it seems like they're happy to be just a business partner helping them protect U.S. users' data.
You're a gem, as always. LA Bureau, that's where we find Bloomberg News technology reporter Alex Barinka.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
We've talked a lot about the trade. We've talked about different economic indicators. We've got a really cool one.
We do. And there's a problem. We've got a plumbing problem. And Carol, it's a cost that all of us are paying for. Despite an above average salary, the pace at which the U.S. is minting new plumbers is lagging retirements. The widening plumber deficit matters for households facing hefty charges to fix a leak. I think we've probably all been there.
Totally.
That costs what? And businesses trying to get new buildings completed on time and on budget. In fact, the plumbing deficit cost the U.S. economy a whopping $33 billion in 2022. That's according to one analysis. We know all of this because Bloomberg News global economy reporter Enda Curran writes about it for Bloomberg Business Week. It's the far-reaching consequences of the U.S. plumbing problem. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Enda, Carol and I could not get enough of this story.
Love it.
And it's also something that we talk about a lot because we know how much it costs to hire a plumber. What is it about the plumbing industry that's sort of emblematic of the worker shortage that we're facing here in the U.S.?
So there are some specific kind of stigma issues around plumbing. I mean, as you know, it's such an important function. It goes to the heart of our daily activities and our economy. Without plumbers, we don't have clean drinking water, for example. But speaking to those in the profession, the teachers and the young students who are starting out in their career there, they say that it just doesn't have the appeal of other roles because it's tough physical labor, for example. I spoke to one young plumber who gave the example of having to dig a trench in the open in the middle of summer one day, having started at 5 a.m. that morning. It's seen as dirty work. There's the perception of lying on your back, fixing someone's toilet. And of course, the hours aren't, hours can vary, but they're not seen as especially social compared to other roles. So when you throw all that into it and consider then this conditioning of younger people over the decades that they should gravitate towards the university away from the trades, the end result, speaking to those people in the industry, is that the skilled trades like plumbing just don't feature very highly on the wish list for young students these days in school. They much prefer a university education. But the pitch is you can become a plumber, get a good job, and have much less debt.
Well, how quickly can you become a plumber or an electrician? Because my understanding, and we'll sometimes have someone come into our home, and it's like they've got an apprentice with them who has to do that for, I thought, a substantial period of time. But set the record straight, because is that part of the problem? That is it just taking too long to train them or allow these folks to kind of go out on their own?
Well, it is. It's a process. It's a five-year process that kind of rotates between the practical laboratory work and the tuition in the school. and at the same time being attached to an actual licensed plumber. So over the course of it, it is 5 years before they get their full certification. But along the way, their wages will be increasing. And as I mentioned earlier, they are not accruing the debt that you would be to have to get a, you know, a life skill or trade in some other part of life. The end result, when you do come out of it, you can get a good job, well-paying, and potentially for life if you wanted.
That's what I wanted to hit on here, is we talked so much about the student loan crisis here in the U.S. And I mean, my jaw just drops when I talk to parents about the cost of college for their kids right now. I mean, we're talking upwards of $60,000 to $90,000 per year for a cost of college here in the U.S. at some schools. And you did some looking into the apprenticeship program, some schools for this stuff. How much does it end up costing total for a five-year program?
Yep. So let me give you the example of the Plumbers and Gas Fitters Local 5 Apprenticeship School. Forgive me, I just needed to read it out to get the name right. I went through that school, and they pay the tuition of the students. The money comes from both the unions and the employers.
Hold on, excuse me? They pay the tuition.
Yep.
Say that again.
They pay the tuition for the students for the 5 years.
Okay.
And the students need only pay $1,500 US each over the course of the 5 years. But they are also required to buy a pair of boots and a measuring tape. And this is what, when I speak to the teachers and the students out there, this is a great appeal for them. Like you mentioned, you've got this whole political debate going on about student debt, and you have the legacy of students trying to pay off that debt. Well, here's a walk of life where you can go in, get a good qualification, get a good skill set, that does go beyond fixing toilets, by the way, and then come out of it relatively debt-free and with a good salary.
So obviously the pre-apprenticeship courses that you looked into are just overflowing with students, right?
Well, this is where the rubber hits the road. So I cited an example of a brand new pre-apprenticeship program that has been put on by a community college in Maryland to deliberately attract young people to become plumbers. It's a well-equipped brand new laboratory. They have 18 seats, and they have 3 students who have enrolled. And this is what speaks to the idea of the plumber shortage, why people just aren't necessarily being attracted to it. And again, you speak to the plumbers and the teachers, they say you've got to go into middle school upwards and condition children that A, it's good to have a skill, B, you don't have to, it's not all about university, and then C, they're making the point that schools also have to have practical classes now, like woodwork, for example, allow students to do that, and then along the way they can make up their mind whether it's university or trade.
You know what they need?
Yeah.
They just need more plumbing influencers. Okay? I'm not joking. I heard Paul Brennan laugh. This is not a joke, but this is like a thing on TikTok and Instagram and stuff.
Plumbing influencers?
Influencers for every trade. For woodworking, for plumbing, for cleaning cast iron. I mean, seriously, everything is out there.
Having said that, I mean, you think, I remember like a show like This Old House, like they were trying to recruit students because nobody wanted to do construction anymore. Nobody wants to do this. I mean, but I want to go back to Enda. Does someone really need 5 years to become a plumber? If the demand is such an issue, isn't there, I don't know, like I don't know enough about it. And I certainly want if somebody comes into my house that they do it right so that all of a sudden I don't have a flood. But does it really have to take that long? Is there any move to kind of figure out how to condense the teaching so we can get people out there?
I mean, look, that's obviously a fair question. I'm sure that teachers will be open to that debate. But I have to say, I have a newfound respect for what they do. Having to go along, I shadow them in the classroom, watching what they're doing. You've got the technical side of it, which is the quantitative quotient, learning those blueprints, figuring out their math for the measurements, figuring out how to get the water flowing in the right direction, the right weight, the right pressure. There's a whole technical side to it that I guess I wasn't fully aware of. And then there's the physical side to it and the labor side to it. So it certainly would take some time before you're fully confident that you would let this person run amok in your house. I would imagine it takes a few years at least, but whether that's 4 or 5 years, I'm sure that's probably a valid point for debate, but that's where the program seems to be set at the moment.
Hey, and just in the last 30 seconds, dovetail this with your most recent reporting about just the overall worker shortage and the way that the immigration in the U.S. needs to change in order to fill these jobs.
Yeah, that's right. So these companies, and especially those in construction, say they cannot get the workers. Part of that solution, as we talked about the last time, is legal immigration. But in this case, it speaks to the idea that children at school, if they're encouraged to learn a trade, instead of university could go some way towards filling some of those skills shortages as well.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's like carried out construction, electrician, like there's lots of things. Endicarn, thank you as always. Global economy reporter at Bloomberg News there in our DC bureau. His story featured in the forthcoming issue of Bloomberg Business Week magazine, but you can read it now on the Bloomberg Terminal, of course, at Bloomberg.com/businessweek.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
So if you've been paying any attention, this shouldn't be news to you. Post-pandemic, we face a shortage of healthcare workers. Here's how dire it is, Carol. Last year, the rate of job openings in what's referred to by the Bureau of Labor Statistics as healthcare and social assistance was 7.6%. It's the second highest percentage going all the way back to 2001. That was when the data started being recorded. All of this according to the nonprofit researcher and consultant, Alterium.
All right, so it shouldn't be of any surprise to you that 88% of nurses say that staffing shortages negatively affect patient care.
That's high.
It's a lot. That's almost everybody, right? That's just one of the findings from Incredible Health's annual State of the U.S. Nursing Report. This is a voice that we have been reaching out to for several years now and really giving us a great gut check on what's going on in the nursing community and the healthcare sector overall. Back with us is Dr. Iman Abu-Zaid. She's co-founder and CEO of Incredible Health. It's a marketplace that connects nurses and hospitals, which is why she has a great vantage point of this. Great to have you back with us. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, how are nurses doing? And what's changed? I mean, I do feel like every time or in the last few years, it's not been great for nurses, especially coming off the pandemic. But give us an idea of how they are doing.
That's right. So Incredible Health, we just reached a recent milestone of 1 million nurses in the U.S. Wow. on our platform. So one in three nurses and 1,500 hospitals. So a lot of the data and information I'm sharing today is from that. What we're seeing is that 88% of nurses are pointing to staffing shortages negatively impacting patient care. And that's showing up in several ways. It means that nurses are stating that they're caring for too many patients at a time, that they're performing tasks outside of their job description, and that the understaffing is impacting patient care in the form of medication errors, readmission rates, and so on.
This is not good. I mean, it's concerning if you're considering at all going to a healthcare facility,
right,
or you end up by some sort of accident. We've all been there.
Right.
You know, we all need medical care. This is kind of scary stuff. Dr. Abu-Zaid, in your report, in the research that you've done, in the surveys that you've done, is there any sign of improvement here?
Yeah, there's definitely some good news that we've uncovered. So first is that 80% of nurses plan to stay in the profession until retirement. And this has been a big increase since the years of the pandemic when it was as low as 55%. So their sentiment around staying in the profession is improving. And then also the mental health of nurses is also improving. It's a 6% improvement compared to last year, as we're seeing more and more health systems implement tools and strategies to help the mental health of healthcare workers.
What about the pipeline into the nurses we're going to need over the next 5 years, 10 years, 20 years? How is that looking?
So there's still a lot more work to be done there. The demand on the healthcare system continues to increase because our population is aging. And even though we are graduating more and more nurses every year, it's still not enough to keep up with that demand. So there's still more work to be done there.
Can I just ask you though, is it just folks who don't want to be, we just did a story about younger generation don't want to be plumbers for a lot of different reasons. What about in terms of nursing, which for women for a long time was a really great way into the workforce? But I'm just curious, younger generations, how are they looking at the nursing profession?
So the demand for the nursing profession is actually higher than ever, right? So there's tens of thousands of Americans who want to enter nursing school and they're on wait lists. But we have a bottleneck with nursing schools. They can't train as many as we would like because of their own capacity constraints around faculty. There's also another bottleneck happening after nursing school around training programs. And so we do need more and more training programs. And then we also have a challenge of retirement. So over the next 5 years, 20% of nurses are on track to retire. And so this is an older workforce as well.
So what does it take?
You're right in that it's a very appealing profession from in terms of just expanding socioeconomic opportunities too. And you can really change your life and your family's life by going into nursing, especially given where salaries are today. But we just, you know, we just need to get more of them.
You can also, from the perspective of the work week and determining your own hours. I mean, some of my friends who are in the profession are working 3 days a week and they're working full time. It's a ton of work, but you know, they're getting two extra days at home with their babies, which is pretty cool. Yeah. Hey, Dr. Abuzaid, what does a traditional nursing education look like right now? And is there any opportunity to sort of do the acceleration that we saw during the pandemic, or like a rethink of what it takes to become a nurse, considering there's such a backlog right now?
Absolutely. I mean, it is a regulated profession at the end of the day, and there is licensing involved as well. So the education is the traditional 4-year bachelor's degree, but there are also associate's degrees and RN diplomas that are shorter in duration. We're also seeing more and more community colleges offer nursing programs too. So it's not just the academic, you know, the top tier academic programs and the for-profit organizations, but we're seeing more and more community colleges offer nursing programs too, which is a great thing.
Are all of them affiliated though with some kind of hospitals? I have a sister who initially, that was her first profession, a nurse, and it was affiliated directly with a hospital. It was right next to it, and you know, they were in the hospital, I think, from the get-go. Are they all like a community program? Are they affiliated so that people actually get, individuals get hands-on experience?
Yes, many of them are affiliated with the health system, because once it comes to the clinical training, which is part of nursing school as well, you do have to do it at a facility as well. And so we're seeing more and more of that as well as more health systems form partnerships with nursing schools.
What are you seeing on the platform right now in terms of the burnout that you referenced and about different types of resources that are becoming available as these health systems realize they need to make sure to retain this talent?
Yeah, so we're seeing a variety of trends. So one I wanted to mention is AI, actually. Mm-hmm. So 90% of nurses have not used AI yet, but for those that have used it, they've used it for recommendations on patient care, for improving the patient intake process, and they've used it in their job search process as well through Incredible Health, because we offer a whole range of AI features to accelerate and enhance the job search experience. So that's an interesting piece from this year's study that we didn't see as much in previous years.
Well, how much further can it go in terms of AI, artificial intelligence, really helping out this profession?
So, you know, the majority of nurses, over 60% of nurses, believe AI is going to have a negative impact on their employment or a negative impact on the industry. But honestly, I do think that's just part of the fear, uncertainty, and doubt that exists among all Americans around AI, just because it's not in prevalent in widespread use yet. And should, you know, that uncertainty should come down over time.
Dr. Abuzaid, I am just wondering though, you know, there's a lot of times I hear conversations with my colleagues in my own home of just trying to access a doctor and they're like, sure, you can have an appointment in 6 months, or just, you know, we're seeing stresses in the healthcare system. And obviously from the conversations we've had for you for quite some time, you know, across the board, certainly in the nursing community, I mean, are we in crisis? Are we headed for a crisis in some regard, as you look at kind of the trends and the numbers of people coming in and who want to continue to do this job?
So our surveys of hospital executives show that 80% of hospital executives do describe the nursing shortage as a crisis. Mm. And when you look at the statistics from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you see that we are the gap between the demand for healthcare and the supply of healthcare workers continues to grow. And that trend is on projected to continue for many decades to come.
Hey, before we let you go, just in the last 30 seconds, I want to go back to AI, because you also have some other interesting research about AI, not just who's using it. But do you think AI can help alleviate in the coming years the shortage of nurses?
Absolutely. There's certain aspects of a nurse's role that can be supported with AI, certain very specific tasks like patient intake and like creating care summaries, like determining the next recommendations for patient care. And we see that in use with doctors as well. And so it's only a matter of time before it starts impacting nurses' tasks as well, which hopefully will help them to do more with their time.
Always important to kind of find out what's going on, certainly in this area. Dr. Abuzaid, thank you so much. Appreciate you checking in with us once again. Dr. Iman Abuzaid, co-founder, chief executive officer of Incredible Health, joining us there from Austin, Texas.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
All right, let's see what our job to the close guest has to say. George Young, back with us, partner portfolio manager at Villery & Company, back with us from New Orleans. Last time I think we talked, we were actually in New Orleans with you. How are you?
I'm doing great. Yeah, I do remember it last time. That was great.
Yeah, it was fun to be there and get another slice of life around this country.
Market's a lot different since then.
Yeah, exactly. How are you seeing it? Quite a run-up, right, in terms of the equity trade. Is it time to maybe, I hate to say, take some money off the table, take some profits? What's the smart take right now in this environment?
Well, two things. It's been kind of a tale of two cities in a lot of ways because the S&P is up 36%. That's been fantastic. But if you slice it, look at it a little bit more carefully, it's a different story because there are a lot of stocks that haven't participated. S&P up 36%, but on the other hand, the rest of the market, if you look at the equal weighting of the S&P, it's up only 23%. So that's great. But what's happened is the really popular stocks, the Magnificent Seven, which represent 30% of the S&P, have done really well. But that means that there's great valuations to be anticipated on stocks that are telling at a bit of a discount to the S&P's historic earnings. So we think there's opportunity there. But again, don't fall in love with a stock. It'll never love you back. So you need to be taking some chips off the table where you've made money and put into things that haven't participated and have some patience. I think that's the hallmark there.
What's a stock that wouldn't love someone back right now?
Well, I think one of those is a play on the consumer being Caesars, meaning there are a lot of folks that love to game, love domestic gambling, and they will go to Vegas and they'll go to a lot of.
You're saying this is one that would love you back.
That will love you back eventually, yeah. But it's cheap right now. Now in terms of a stock that probably you should sell, I mean, on everybody's lips nowadays is NVIDIA. You can't get enough NVIDIA. Any cocktail party you go to, you hear about artificial intelligence. So in that case, I would say NVIDIA to pick one that is overvalued, I think that's one that should be sold or at least sell a portion of. Take some chips off the table, to use a gambling analogy.
So
is that a stock that
I just want to make sure. Go ahead, Carol.
Is that a stock that you shouldn't love right now that won't love you back? Is that your take?
That is correct. NVIDIA and a lot of the Magnificent Seven are overvalued, and they're stocks that people say, I'll never sell them, and that never makes any sense.
So interesting to hear that right now. I mean, do you think that the market is poised for some sort of bigger pullback right now? It's, again, a day like today where we are seeing a risk-off mood, still reminding people the S&P 500 is up more than 7.7% this year.
Correct. No, I remain optimistic about it because I think really the consumer is still strong. The unemployment numbers remain somewhat low. Consumers still spending, and that's really what drives the economy. That's 60% plus of what this economy is all about. And again, here at Villery, we invest domestically. We don't look internationally. Domestic is our focus.
Hey, let me ask you something. Performance is always important. And I just, you know, you guys and your fund, it's a balanced fund. Year to date, it's up about 4.5%. According to Bloomberg data, that puts you in the 56th percentile against your peers. 5 year, you're up just shy of 4%, and that puts you in the 5th percentile. I am curious, conversations you have with investors in terms of performance and what you think might have potentially held you back.
Right. We've been more small and mid-cap focused and more value focused. If you look at what happened last year, 2023, the exact opposite is what did well. The large cap growth stocks did well. The small cap value didn't. But what you have to do is figure there's always a regression to the mean. So those stocks that did particularly well, there's a rotation in the marketplace. And those that haven't performed, and we happen to have a number of those, we think they're good value. We think they're going to come out on top soon enough.
When, though? That's the question, because every year we hear it's going to be a year of value, and it hasn't happened. And small caps for years have been under pressure, at least against the performance of the S&P 500. So when are we going to see that?
Right. Well, part of the reason for that is passive investing. All the passive investing has really increased over the last 10 years or so. So that means that money is going blindly, and I don't mean this to be critical, but it's blindly going into pools where it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So the large cap stocks are getting the attention because that's where passive investing is going. At some point, I think it's important to remember that what we do in the investment world is really not a popularity contest. It's really a weighing machine over time as opposed to a voting machine. So stocks are seldom cheap and popular at the same time. And it's interesting because there are a lot of people that don't respect that old adage. And I think it makes a lot of sense. You got to have some patience.
New money, you talked about Caesars. Progressive is another company that I believe that you are keen on. Talk to us about the take on that one.
Sure. So Progressive, everybody knows Flo. They've done a great job marketing. And what's interesting is they're really recognized as auto insurer. But what they've done is moved into bundling. So not just cars now, but home, commercial insurance, higher risk general liability policies. They've really done a good job in marketing themselves and extending throughout the insurance world. Fantastic company. Continues to show good growth. Pays a little dividend while you wait.
What else is on your radar?
Well, I mentioned Caesars earlier. Yeah. I think that's worth revisiting.
Okay.
The problem with Caesars, a lot of people are concerned about the leverage that it has. And again, with interest rates, as you talked about before I came on, they've been moving up in the last year and a half or so. So leverage, any sort of debt concern, is something that's on a lot of investors' mind. In this case, we think that over time, given the steady flow of gaming interest, there's going to be an opportunity for them to deleverage, and they've taken action on that so far. Plus, they've got a big property on the Strip in Vegas, which they're likely to be selling in due course. They have been hinting about that for 2 years now.
Yeah, our BI team definitely notes that the margins are still strong at Caesars, but they're concerned about some of the elevated operating costs and cost pressures this year. Is that something that you think investors might then have to be patient maybe for some returns because of those concerns? Just got about 30 seconds left.
Yeah, not overly concerned about that, but I think online gaming is really what people should focus on. That's really taken off. They've done a great job marketing that and managing it. So that's what I would really focus on.
Yeah, our BI team saying digital segment sales could rise 28% in 2024 after that unit earned EBITDA finally in 2023, or in 2023, I should say. Hey, listen, George, thank you so much. George Young, he's partner and portfolio manager at Villery and Company out there in New Orleans.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast.
Available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern
on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app.
You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.